From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life.
I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Whether your mental or physical wellness brings you to the top of the highest peaks,
or you need a little help with the climb,
The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch.
You know, we live in an age in which scams are the new normal. A charismatic entrepreneur sells thousands of tickets to a festival that never happened. Respected investors pour millions into a startup centered around fake blood tests. Our next guest is journalist Gabrielle Bluestone. She joins us to take us on the journey through all the scams that have very likely had some of us falling for them. Her new book is Hype: How Scammers, Grifters, and Con Artists Are Taking Over the Internet and Why We're Following. Gabrielle Bluestone, welcome to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, I just have to say that the Netflix documentary Fire, that's F-Y-R-E for the festival that never happened, opens with you as executive producer in one of the first scenes talking about it. And it's fascinating and also kind of difficult to understand because all of the hype around the festival and all the trouble they went to makes it look like, why didn't they just pull it off as this great festival? Was it about, you know, disrupting the industry of I guess it's the booking industry, and then the festival was just a scam, a total scam?
Well, so my impression reporting on the festival was not that Billy McFarland, who was the CEO of Fire Media, wasn't that he necessarily wanted to scam all of these people. I think he saw an opportunity in the tech world and startup industry to get a lot of money and to live the kind of lifestyle that he had been seeing on Instagram. Instagram has become this like cesspool of conspicuous consumption where people are presenting lives that don't necessarily reflect reality, but you kind of get to live that way on the internet and you can trick other people into believing that. And so, you know, he was a big fan of these models that he hired to promote the festival. He was a big fan of the private jet lifestyle. And so he realized that he could then sell that idea to investors and that they would also buy into that fantasy. And so the problem was he spent all that money on the models and on the private jets and on the private islands, so that when it actually came time to put on the festival, there was just nothing left.
I see. Okay. And so he raised literally millions of dollars from investors who believed in what he was doing. And boy, that the advertisements and the way that the documentary comes together, it really looks like it was something amazing. Of course, now Billy McFarland, is he behind bars, or what ended up happening there?
Well, that is a very interesting story. He has served 3 years of his 6-year sentence so far. But one of the most fascinating elements of covering the story to me was that after he got busted for the Fire Festival, he was out on bail and he launched another felony scam that was offering exclusive access to events like the Met Gala and Burning Man and the Victoria's Secret Fashion Show. And these were all events that you really couldn't get tickets to at that time. For example, the Met Gala, you actually have to be personally approved by Anna Wintour, even if you are an underwriter of the event. She still has to approve the executives who go. So it would have taken very little research to figure out that what he was offering, again, he couldn't fulfill. But I think people were so intrigued by the opportunity to experience that lifestyle that he was able to steal another $100,000 while he was out on bail for the first set of felonies. And it still hasn't stopped. So behind bars, he got caught with a recording device, I believe in 2018 or 2019. And he had been at this white collar prison in upstate New York that was close to his parents. Michael Cohen was a prisoner there. He was apparently Scrabble buddies with Mike the Situation Sorrentino from Jersey Shore. So it was not all that different from his original life. But when he got caught with the recording device, he was sent to a facility in Ohio. And he was put into solitary confinement. And then he tried to launch a podcast from prison in Ohio. And he was put back in solitary confinement. So it's been kind of a very wild, unfortunate ride for him behind bars, but still no less fantastic than his pre-prison life.
Wow, I can only imagine him trying to do selfies and Instagram posts from prison and networking from prison. And, you know, I just imagine that the background wouldn't be spectacular. It's interesting that one has that much ability to promote oneself, to monetize that, and that people are willing to follow and invest financially, emotionally. What's the underlying psychology that's going on with the audience and the viewers that give him credibility in a sense?
I think it's really indicative of the time that we're living in right now. I mean, you have billions of dollars flowing into these tech startups, often based on nothing more than a concept or the marketing. And so Billy McFarland was not an outlier in that sense. I don't think he was that different from Adam Newman, from Elizabeth Holmes, you know, even from Uber, which is, you know, one of the most revered tech companies there is that has never turned a profit. And so he kind of just capitalized on this industry where, you know, WeWork, it was an office subleasing company, but it was sold to investors and to the public as this new age, mystical, you know, global revolution. And the people that are receiving this marketing also take it as real because you have the media buying into that as well. You know, when the Fyre Festival marketing first came out, because there were so many celebrities involved and because it was such a beautiful, slick promotional video, you had legacy media like Vanity Fair and Vogue hyping it up as the party of the century. So as a consumer, you see the celebrities that you admire and follow online advertising it. You see the news agencies that you know, take as truth telling you to go. Why wouldn't you buy into it?
So how much responsibility does the media have in this? I mean, you know, there's a sense where, you know, he's obviously responsible for the initiation of it, but as a society and as a media, if we're promoting it and we're giving it credibility, I mean, when we give it attention, we have, and we're, you know, we are giving it credibility. So how much responsibility do we have?
I think we have a lot of responsibility. And, you know, I came up as a blogger. I definitely understand the pressures around this 24-hour news cycle. But it's very, you know, it's very difficult for an everyday ordinary consumer to tell the difference between, you know, a vetted, fact-checked Vanity Fair investigation or article and a blog that goes up on the Vanity Fair website. And so there is this pressure to, if something is happening, if something is trending, to get a piece up on it. And there's often not as much vetting as you would think going into it. You know, I don't know what the solution is, but certainly a little bit more critical thinking could be involved in these.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, our guest is journalist Gabrielle Bluestone. She has written a new book called Hype: How Scammers, Grifters, and Con Artists Are Taking Over the Internet and Why We're Following. So one of the big reasons that we're following, Gabrielle, I think has to do with that lovely little acronym, FOMO, fear of missing out, and whether or not it's a fear of missing out at the beginning of some great startup that might make you, you know, bazillion dollars, or the, you know, party of the century. We have fallen prey to FOMO, and it's a phenomenon of social media, I think. What are the questions that we have to ask ourselves, or what are the checks and balances that we should be doing? Because I think the obvious ones are just that, obvious, that we see on social media. But the others that aren't quite so obvious, we should be asking ourselves a few questions about.
Well, that was one of the things that really led me to write this book, because I could, you know, it's very interesting what Billy McFarland did and what he got away with. But the more interesting question to me was why it worked so well. You know, you would think, I mean, some of the most tech savvy members of their generations attended this festival. You would think that you know, being so online, we would have more tools than ever to uncover these bad actors. But I think that we're actually falling more prey to them than ever. You know, Billy McFarland's scheme wasn't original. There was a guy in the 1800s named Gregor MacGregor who sold a bunch of bank bonds to a country that didn't exist and then sent two boats of settlers to their death, basically, as part of the scheme. So it was very similar to the Fyre Festival, but it didn't have the reach that Billy McFarland did, and that's because of social media. And I think that there is this pressure to present a version of yourself online, and then you see it's a, you know, keeping up with the Joneses kind of thing. You want your page to be just as good as your friend's page. You want to show that you're having as much fun or as cool as the people around you. And so FOMO really plays into that. There are a lot of studies that show, you know, internet use is really increasing negative emotions. There's a sharp uptick in jealousy and loneliness and unhappiness from what we're seeing online. And again, you know, a lot of these pressures are nothing new. There's a 1950s study from Solomon Ash where he put a bunch of people in a room and showed them three straight lines and then showed them a fourth line and asked them which one matched with the other lines. What they didn't know was that there were Confederates planted in the room who would choose an obviously wrong answer to see if it affected them. And 75% of the participants ended up going along with the wrong answer just because they didn't want to step out of line. They wanted, you know, they felt pressure to the peer pressure of it. So to circle back to your original question, I think an important way of noticing when this is happening to you is to recognize what emotions are being triggered and to ask yourself why someone would want to trigger those emotions. And that can help you to stop in the moment and identify what's going on a bit better.
I want to ask you about the things that you see on social media. Maybe, you know, you're on a site, you know, a legitimate site, but then there are these pop-ups and sometimes you're sort of, you know, you're interested in following them. And I've, the ones that have like a picture and a couple little lines that are really poorly written, I have to say a lot of the writing seems like it's written by like a junior high school level person. And then you have to click to get to the next one. The other day, I saw this fascinating one by this dermatologist who had discovered this amazing, you know, thing. And I thought, this is so interesting that they force you to kind of click through. And I have to say, I wasn't sold on it, but it was like this sociological study. Like, why do people click through on these things when it's such a long, drawn out, boring to me drama? Maybe it's kind of interesting to someone, but, you know, you're always, if you click all the way to the 36th page, you know, you're going to get your pot of gold at the end of the rainbow or find out what that magical secret is to longevity or looking young or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. What is up with those kind of scams? I mean, maybe they're not even scams. I don't know.
I think it comes down to what a lot of this boils down to, which is just really good marketing, right? Everyone loves a cliffhanger. You always want to find out what's happening at the end. But it's actually funny that you mentioned the dermatology because there's a section of the book in which I met with some of, you know, the country's top dermatologists and plastic surgeons who are actually responsible for a lot of the so-called Instagram face that you're seeing a trend towards, especially among millennials and Gen Z. And they said that there is a tremendous pressure in that industry. A lot of the doctors that you're seeing with social media pages are actually photoshopping their results. And it's very difficult to call that out in the medical industry. And they also see a lot of pressure for procedures that they know don't necessarily work or do anything, but their patients are seeing them online and calling them up and asking for it to the point that they just feel pressure to get it because there is such a large response to it. So it's everywhere and it's in every industry and it's pretty bad.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and bring it back to Park City for our content here. And we all, the listeners here, everybody in the community is, are probably guilty of not always revealing real life and promoting our beautiful lives here in Park City and the mountains and the snow that I'm watching fall down in the sky. And those who are our families and friends that are living out east probably hate us and have some resentment and feel like we might be promoting a false reality, which sometimes we are. But how much responsibility, you know, as the people creating those Instagrams, do we have to hashtag promote real life? What responsibility do we have?
Well, I mean, in a perfect world, I think everyone would be showing their accurate life, right? But in the same way that I think a lot of people maybe fudge their resumes a little, our social media pages are kind of resumes for our personalities and for our lives. Actually, one of my favorite recent scammer cases just came out of Salt Lake City, where one of the Real Housewives was arrested for running a long-term phone scam, and she's been accused of creating lead lists of people who are likely to be vulnerable to scammers, and then actually helping to scam them. In that case, is winding its way through the court. But what was interesting about that too is the way that she presented herself on the show. She and her family rented a house that was larger than the house that they actually lived in to pretend that they had more money and that they were living a lifestyle that they weren't living. And I do have to say, I'm very jealous of the way you guys live out there. I'm in New York City and there's no mountains and no snow. And I'm hoping when lockdown is over to experience it for myself.
Well, it's true. So I wasn't going to try to, you know, fake it. No, it really is a great existence here in the mountains. But I work also in a lot of the running industry and the biking industry. And it's really interesting to see people's content where, just like the Wives of Salt Lake, I don't know if I even watched that show, but a lot of people will post these images of them in the mountains and them, you know, biking in these exotic places, and you know they're not really there. And it's creating this illusion that they're performing at some kind of high capacity or rate. And, you know, it's gotten to the point where many people are starting to counter that and post these really dramatic photos or images of them suffering or at the worst moments during their adventures. That's what I'm kind of curious is, do we have a responsibility to actually counter that beautification on Instagram?
Well, it's funny. One of my favorite case studies in the book was an influencer who wanted to pretend to go on vacation. So she went to IKEA and shot a bunch of shots that were supposed to be her at a hotel in Bali. And her followers all fell for it. On the other hand, and you do see there's a private jet studio in Los Angeles that a lot of influencers were busted using. You can rent it for, I think, $40 an hour and pretend that you're on a private jet. You can do a photo shoot, you know, you looking out the window, that typical influencer shot. But there is this trend also, and it's really weird and kind of disturbing, towards performative authenticity, where people are, you know, selecting things that are, you know, vulnerable, but are also very calculated. And I think you see that a lot with influencers now, who will post, you know, quote unquote, makeup free selfies that are still filtered. I don't know if you saw over last weekend, an unedited picture of Khloe Kardashian was released on the internet. And it became kind of a Barbara Streisand effect because her lawyers had so many cease and desists going that it blew up into a really big story. And to show that that was, you know, not a real picture of her, she filmed a video in a darkly lit room that was supposed to show her actual body, but you could see there was filtering software on it that kind of glitched midway through it. So it's a little disturbing that even these authentic, vulnerable moments tend to be largely calculated. And it's not just people deluding other people. I think we are deluding ourselves too. I really truly believe that if the Fyre Festival had managed to put a couple artists on stage or just some semblance, you know, a couple steps more than they achieved, that the people there really would have pretended to have been having the time of their lives and posted content on social media talking about the concert of the century.
So interesting. This is a great conversation. And I think that I wanted to talk a little bit about youth and technology versus, you know, older generations. And I had read somewhere I mean, a lot of people think that QAnon is a scam, but it's middle-aged women who are most likely to fall for QAnon, which makes me believe that you know, when you don't know as much about technology and about filters and the way you can rent a jet for $40 an hour and, you know, put your Instagram video up or whatever, then you're more likely to believe that it is true, whatever you see on social media. I see my own parents doing this a lot as well. And I'm wondering, in the case of, I think it's so interesting, Elizabeth Holmes, so a Stanford dropout at age 19, she founds this company that is blood testing, which to me sounds like a great idea. Like blood testing, you can do at home. And there are savvy investors that invest, you know, some $700 million into Theranos, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. And I think it was all a scam. But even savvy investors at that point, who maybe are a little bit older, are believing in this, wow, the youth and the innovation and the disruption. So what about that?
Yeah, I talked to the number of people involved in the tech world and in the VC world. And there is this cult of founder that has kind of taken over the industry, especially in these cases like with Theranos, where it's this new technology that might still be being developed. What these people are investing in isn't the product, it's the founder. And again, it comes down to, you know, it's really all marketing. So Elizabeth Holmes, you know, she had the Stanford background. She created this mysterious character who spoke in a deep voice and always wore black turtlenecks that was inspired by Steve Jobs. And so she really learned how to appeal to these people who were looking for someone to invest in, not necessarily a company, but a person. And it was kind of amazing because she got these professionally rich people to hand over their money. She had Henry Kissinger on the board of directors and, you know, the Walton family from Walmart hyping her up. And I think once you get one or two people like that on board with you, the rest of the people aren't doing the due diligence. They're looking to see who else is doing it and jumping on the bandwagon. Yeah, I mean, people saw through it. Her college professors were warning that this was not real, that she didn't have the background to do it. But the wave of hype and the wave of marketing was so strong that it really drowned out those voices.
Mm. That's so interesting. Yeah, Henry Kissinger, again, older generation. But yes, I would think if Warren Buffett went for something, I'd say, well, Warren Buffett does his due diligence. I'm going for it too. But again, it's that burden of proof that we have to have. It's our responsibility. But what is the responsibility of the influencer? And it's funny that, you know, until about 5 years ago, I thought an influencer was just a celebrity that could lend their name to a product and then you would believe in it but it turns out that influencers can be just about anyone and they can really be kind of faking their endorsement of something just because they're getting free product. Mm-hmm. What's their responsibility?
So one of my favorite things that I found while researching this book was a movie that I believe came out in 2009. It was written well before the rise of social media, and it was called The Joneses. And it was about a marketing company that would hire attractive family members, place them in a fake family, and drop them into a community where they would, you know, be the Joneses family, and all the neighbors would want to keep up with them. So, you know, it was David Duchovny and Demi Moore, and they're such an attractive, gregarious couple that the people around them soon started to buy the same products that they were using. You know, they drove an Audi around town and all of a sudden everyone in town wanted to buy an Audi. And what I thought was super interesting about this was it predicted and defined the role of an influencer long before that job was ever really even real. And so I interviewed the writer and director of that film who told me he had been inspired by a real Campari campaign where they hired models to go into bars and order Campari, hoping to inspire, you know, the men and women at the bar to be like them or buy them their drink. So I don't know if necessarily the influencers really owe us that much. I think as consumers, we need to be aware of how much is just marketing and advertising and how we're really accepting it as, you know, real life.
Well, many people believe the peaks were placed here in Park City for that same exact reason. So, Lynn, we know the real truth behind your existence here. You have a chapter dedicated to COVID also in your book. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And kind of give us a little teaser for the audience on you added that, I'm sure, after COVID, but it probably wasn't the initial part of the text, but a natural fit.
Yeah, well, I was finishing this book as COVID hit, and it really seemed to me a natural continuation of all the topics and themes in the book leading up to that, right? With COVID, we were locked in our houses and living primarily online, which is where most of these scams are rooted and taking place. And I saw, first you have this percentage of Americans who don't believe that COVID's real because of what they're reading on the internet or are denying the science behind it. I think it's the same thing that's kind of leading us towards, as you mentioned before, QAnon and this idea that the election was stolen. But at the same time, you also saw this huge outrising in scams. I think the New York Times estimated that Americans lost $145 million to COVID-related scams, whether that's fake coronavirus tests, fake PPE, fake cures, fake stimulus relief. People have been really susceptible to it. And that it's not just COVID-themed scams either. There's been a huge rise in animal shelter scams where you see a picture or a video of, sad-looking animals on the internet and you're inspired to donate money. So those things have been thriving. But I also think that maybe we're going in kind of a positive direction because this last year has really forced people to take a look at what's important and what's essential. And rather than look at what we don't have or what other people have, I think we've kind of turned inwards to focus on what we do have and how much that means to us. So I'm hoping that, we'll see a positive trend from that. I do think that there has been kind of a turn away from that conspicuous consumption that I referenced earlier. Even the celebrities who make their lifestyle on showing off how much they have realized like, oh, this is a little off tone. Like, let's tone it down a little. So maybe this will be the turning point for society. I sure hope so.
Me too. I think Lynn and I are crossing our fingers for that. It does seem juxtaposed to, the trend in mental health that people are struggling and they're struggling to understand their identities. So I certainly hope that people are being more introspective and that they're more comfortable with themselves and the honesty of their existence. Is there anything, walk away as we kind of wrap up our interview, that you feel like, hey, make sure you're doing this to put yourself in a good place with social media and your presence on the internet?
Yeah, well, one of the healthiest things that I did for myself personally during the last year was to unfollow all of these marketers and influencers. And I have instead been following, accounts and content that really adds to my life, enriches my life. So I'm obsessed with this account that is, I think it's called Men with a Pot. And it's just two men that go out into this beautiful forest and cook things over a fire. And it is so relaxing and lovely. They're not trying to sell me anything. I think the important thing, especially in media, you hear people say this a lot, like Twitter is a hell site or Instagram is the worst place on earth. They're bad because of who we are choosing to follow. We are creating this existence and we can uncreate it. It's within our power. So if I leave anyone with any message, I hope it's that.
Well, so two men with a pot and the mountain life on KPCW, of course.
Definitely.
Gabrielle Bluestone is our guest. Her new book is Hype, How Scammers, Grifters, and Con Artists Are Taking Over the Internet and Why We're Following, most important. Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Mountain Life.
If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe, rate us, and leave us a comment.
If you have an idea for a future show, email us at mountainlife@kpcw.org.
We hope you'll bring your green smoothie and join us next week for The Mountain Life.